Well, I've given people 3 extra minutes, so I think we'll get started. Good afternoon. My name is Tom Bailey. I'm senior consultant at Towers Perrin, and welcome to the session on underwriting cycles. Are they unavoidable? I can remember, I'm going to date myself a little bit, back in the late 70s, early 80s, when Bill Bailey, then president of Aetna, thought that Aetna could be the one to lead the industry out of the soft cycle, and we began to raise rates for automobile insurance, and we were very wrong, and we lost a lot of business. So does a company need to know about the underwriting cycle? I believe so. Do they need to know where the industry is or where the industry and they are in that cycle? I believe so, and we'll talk more about it as we go through the session today about whether they are unavoidable or not. We have some interesting speakers today, and before I introduce them, I thought I could tee up this session with some information on where I think we as a firm think the industry is in the cycle. So let me give you a couple of pieces of information here. From a pricing standpoint, from our commercial lines insurance pricing survey called CLIPS, we've seen a weakening for several quarters of pricing, commercial lines pricing, and this is year over year price level changes. As this says, with no end in sight, but it might be possible as we look out at the far right of that slide that in 2008 it looks like maybe prices are starting to turn a little bit. And of course the little bit of firmness that came in the 2005 timeframe was because of what happened to property rates during that time. As far as the overall, in terms of a measurement of combined ratio, it appears that the industry came from a peak in 2001 in terms of very high combined ratios, dropping to a trough in 2004. Actually, the trough probably is 2004, 2006, if you were to take out the effect of Katrina, of KRW, Katrina, Rita, and Wilma in 2005. But the combined ratios are starting to rise in 2007, and we forecasted out 2008 and 2009. Still pretty good combined ratios from about 2003 on, because if you look at the red dotted line, that's our estimate of an economic hurdle rate. So if the combined ratio is under that, the industry is making money. But it looks like the combined ratios are beginning to rise, and the question is, where are they going to go, particularly with interest rates being at very, very low levels. So this is just a short snapshot. I think we'll see a bigger picture of what has happened historically within the industry. So let me introduce now our speakers for this afternoon. The first is Spencer Gluck. He is Senior Vice President with INSTRAT, the Actuarial and Risk Analysis Division of Guy Carpenter. He previously served as Chief Actuary for Girling Global Financial Products and for Swiss Re New Markets. After many years in consulting with Milman and KPMG. Spencer is an FCAS and a member of the Academy, and has bachelor's and master's degrees from Cornell University. And he'll be our first speaker. And then we'll be joined by Matt Mosher. Matt is Senior Vice President of the Property Casualty Rating Division of AM Best, an independent insurance information and rating service, which I'm sure many of you, if not all of you, are familiar with. Matt oversees the rating and reporting on over 4,000 property casualty insurance companies in over 50 countries around the world. In this role, Matt chairs the rating committee for property casualty companies worldwide and also serves on AM Best Corporate Rating Policy Committee, which is responsible for establishing the rating criteria. He's been at AM Best since 1995. Prior to joining them, Matt spent 2 years in consulting and 7 years within the U.S. property casualty insurance industry. He is a graduate of Lehigh University with a B.S. in statistics. He is also a fellow of the Casualty Actuarial Society and a member of the Academy. So I'm going to turn it over now to Spencer. Go.
Thanks, Tom. I kind of struggled, came up with a title, which kind of gives away the punchline. That's how it comes out. It's not where I started from. I didn't actually start out studying underwriting cycles at all. It's an interesting output of the analysis and modeling work that I was doing. I'm a denizen of the casualty loss reserve seminar over the years. I've actually been an actuary for a lot of years, and I've never been to this one before, so pleased to meet you all. And so it's going to sound sometimes like I'm talking about reserves, because to some degree I started from looking at reserves, but I think the points I'm going to make and the issues with regard to reserves are pricing issues as well, and as you can see, they're cycle issues. And especially my real area of interest these days and for quite some time is risk and risk models. And I'm of the opinion that we as a group, I mean actuaries, and not just TAR and the insurance industry, but we've got a long way to go into having models that really understand properly what our risks are. And I'm very involved in ERM, and of course, in the world of ERM, people are supposed to actually make business decisions based on risk models. So we better pay a lot of attention to that, and that's what I've been working on. And so some of that looks like reserve risk, and I've been focused on systemic risks, risks that don't diversify, because those are the ones that really survive at the enterprise level, and reserve risk and time risks, because, you know, a lot of times we don't recognize in our models that we are making forecasts, that the thing we're forecasting is in the future. It's not just a matter of parameter risk, it's a matter of forecasting into the future, and what about the risk that everything changes? So that's the risk that I've been focused on trying to find out more about. So now I've made this kind of busy, lots too many words on the page slide right here. Just to have a little intro that's on the specific stated topic of the day, the cycle, and is it avoidable? And the version or the part of the cycle that I'm going to be focusing on is the information lag cycle, which I think it's fairly uncontroversial that's an obvious part of the cycle. Now, obviously, there are other things going on. There are interest rates. There's just capital shortage or sufficiency as a whole. There are many other things that will drive the cycle as well, but certainly the information lag cycle is a big part. So the simple version, to say the cycle in a simple way, we just say, well, the competitive behavior is driven by the accounting results reported in the last few years. Are people making money as they are recording it? Are they losing money? Is their surplus going up? Is their surplus going down? So that's too simple. You might say, well, of course, we know better than to just look at the calendar year reported results. But one reason the cycle is kind of unavoidable is because, especially in the liability lines, the long tail lines of business, which is where my focus is usually and will be today, there's always positive cash flow. There's no natural cash flow discipline like you would have in a manufacturing type business. The premiums always come way ahead of the loss payments, and with no cash flow discipline, the cycle might be driven by the least realistic competitor rather by the most efficient or lowest cost competitor. It's whoever estimates their costs to be the lowest. And so 90% of everybody can be really smart, and 10% can drive the price down. So that's one of the problems of this industry, where there's no cash flow constraint. I'm talking about doing more, but don't we know more than we used to? Well, for example, over the last 30 years, there's been a lot of work in the insurance industry on price monitoring. The significance of 30 years is that's how long I remember, that's how long I've been working. And at the beginning of those 30 years, there was really companies in the commercial lines had very little good information about how much money they were actually charging, what their prices really were, because commercial lines pricing has so much flexibility in the field, and it still does. But there's been a lot of work done, so we certainly have much better pricing knowledge about what prices are being charged than we did a long time ago. But just caution with each one, price monitoring, and this would go to the Tom was showing you when prices, that's just price. Price is not the whole cycle. Underwriting is the other half of the cycle, and I'm not sure how much is much, but we know whatever cycle you can find by price, the real cycle is going to be deeper than that, because price is only part of it. And then, finally, let's look at the losses, not just the premiums. Don't we know better or do we know better as an industry? Do we really know better than the numbers in the financial statements? Of course, most of the world believes that we really do. And in fact, if you could do the chain ladder, and I'm sorry, I just mean development factors. When I say the chain ladder, that's a common, the common international name for the method that we all do most of the time. So if you just do a chain ladder projections on industry data, and I'll do workers' comp is going to be my example line. Workers' comp paid industry projections of ultimate are way more accurate over time than industry booked loss ratios. I'm about two-thirds of the variation is taken out. You've only got a third less variation if you just a simple paid chain ladder on the industry data. But what's left over is still cyclical, which doesn't make that much sense, but we're going to be going through that. You know, it's paid data, and yet if you project paid to ultimate, you still have errors that are cyclical. So there's something in the data, and that's what we're going to be exploring in great detail. Now, another thing is that the chain ladder on the industry data, anyway, is less accurate the more development factors you average. I've used average of the last two as we go on, because with back testing, that's the most accurate. But the reality is one development factor alone, if you use the last diagonal of development factors on the industry data as your forecast, that might actually be slightly better than the average of the last two. Go to average 3, 4, 5. As you add more, projection gets worse and worse, more inaccurate. It's an interesting finding, but it's true. But now you get down to individual company data, you might not be able to do that. So I'm saying, well, you just do the chain ladder on industry data, you're much more accurate. But now you're at the individual company, you're not on industry data. You may have to look back to more development factors because your data is not as stable. And, you know, on the industry data, I can do a paid chain ladder on workers' comp, get a pretty good answer for the last accident year because there's so much data. And, you know, workers' comp's not the worst line for that. But at the industry, at the individual company level, those immature accident years, you're going to have to go to Bornheeder-Ferguson things, then you get back to price monitoring and all those other issues. So I think, of course, as an industry, let's be honest, if we did it, we know that the actuarial projection is way better than the number that, at least for the industry as a whole, maybe not for your company, but for the industry as a whole, is much more accurate than what's booked. But there are limitations. Okay, so if I'm talking about being interested in long tail lines, so it's workers' comp, I'm talking about wanting to look at risk over time, this time aspect. So I'm going to need a long database, and I'm also talking about systemic risk that doesn't diversify. So I want to look at industry data, something big. So start with just a little triangle. That's just regular old Schedule P triangle, and so there's the accident year. Notice I've labeled development years start as whole numbers starting with zero. That doesn't matter because I don't think I'll refer to that again anyway. but I did. And then here's the calendar year of payment. Oft-neglected calendar year is going to be very key in what I'm showing you. But that's just a little triangle. And I said it's Schedule P, but it's from Schedule P, which is, means we started with Schedule P. But to get this data clean enough to use, was a big job. The biggest problem is aggregate excess of loss reinsurance. There was a fair amount of it. Sometimes it's finite. Sometimes it's even risky, aggregate excess of loss, meaning stop loss kind of business. It was very big in 2000. A lot of it written 2000, 2002, even for big companies, distorts the data. So this is a warning. You use net Schedule P triangles, the industry aggregate numbers, those numbers are distorted, and the distortion is significant. There's also Cigna ACE. Just watch out for the Cigna ACE triangle. It has to do with the merger or something. It's just, if you want to use industry data, find that triangle and subtract it out. It's not usable. I think with legitimate accounting, had to do with acquisition accounting, but one way or another, it just screws the triangle up. By the way, it's incremental losses in the triangle, not cumulative. These are incremental paid losses, and that's the way I'm going to be modeling. I'm going to be modeling incremental losses. I call that the trapezoid, just show you the shape of it. Went to a lot of work to build the industry trapezoid on a consistent, usable basis. So this is to say, can't go out more than 10 years because I built it out of Schedule P, that's all we got. but I went all the way back to accident year 79 through 2007 to get me that long-term database. This workers' comp database is what we're going to be looking at numbers that come from. Okay, the dynamic reserve model. I'm here, among other things, touting this great new reserve model I've built. So I won't spend too much time touting it here, but we will be using results from it, so I'm more or less going to be talking about it. I call it the dynamic reserve model because the word dynamic is very important to me, and we'll see, you know, kind of emphasize that as we go through it. Concept that things really do change over time, and most of the risk models, or almost all of them in the industry today, are not dynamic. They don't really account for that important aspect of risk. So it's a stochastic model for loss reserve development. We're going to be talking a lot about diagnosis of trends and trends uncertainty, whether or not you're talking about loss reserves. And I built it for a more understanding, realistic understanding of risk, even though that's not the main focus of the talk here today. And we got a few differentiating features. The most important one is that first one. I call it dynamic trends. So we're looking for calendar year effects in the data, things that happen on the calendar year, and things and how that calendar year effect can change over time. There's a paper. It's called Stochastic Trends in Casualty and Life Insurance. I co-wrote it with Gary Venter, and we'll be presenting it in about a month at the ERM symposium. So that will show you a lot of what's underlying this filtering aspect of the model, or another, filtering is the algorithm for dynamic trends. We also have a very new feature that very few people have, which is to say we can model paid and outstanding losses simultaneously. It's a way to model incurred losses, but not as incurred losses, as paid and outstanding losses, and how they interact with each other, and how the outstanding either helps or doesn't help predict the paid, depending on what your data says. We won't be looking at that today, though. Okay. There's another busy slide that I'm not going to say everything about. This is kind of just comparing it to what's out there and what other people do. And the whole first section is the most important. We all have been using this chain ladder method, but then somehow we're trying to get to the concept of a model. And there are two popular ways that the chain ladder method has been taken to a model. One of them is an error method by Mach, won a prize like 12 years ago, and the CAS sometimes gives lessons on how to do that method, Mach's method. And then there's another very popular method popularized by England and Verral. They call it bootstrapping. You shouldn't call it bootstrapping because bootstrapping is just the name of a statistical method. It doesn't describe their model at all. I do bootstrapping too. He's using a different model. It's like calling it the standard deviation method. But it's just a statistical word. But in fact, what both of those methods are about, and especially the second one, is the one I would build off, is that you describe the triangle. There's an accident year factor. Think of it as ultimate losses or expected ultimate losses. And there's a development period factor. You call it a payment pattern, call it development factors. And that's all there is. Now, there can be lots and lots of those. You can have, in the chain ladder, you really have tons of parameters. You have a separate parameter for every level of every accident year. You've got 9 development factors to describe a 10-element payment pattern. You probably don't need that many. It's a lot of parameters, but all the parameters are accident years and columns, rows and columns. And what I'm going to show you, and if you actually try to think of these things as models and see if they fit, doesn't fit. No, it'll fit some data, but there's lots and lots of data, which no matter how many parameters you put on rows and columns, you can't fit it. You need to look at the diagonals, because there's stuff hanging on the diagonals. And without it, you don't fit the data. And I'm going to, of course, show you that. Zenworth is another model I start from and use. He's a guy who spent a lot of time on calendar year trends. And I'm not going to tell you why I'm better than why we've made improvements over that model, because slides for another purpose. Here is the two-way model. This is just row factors, column factors, all the parameters. And we fit it to that big trapezoid. And now we're looking at the residuals. And residuals is just what's left over. It's what's left after you've fitted the model. It's what's left over. And if your model fits properly, then your residuals are supposed to be random. Random scatter. So we have a trapezoid of residuals. Right, we had a trapezoid of data, so now we have a trapezoid of residuals, which is just to say the real data compared to the model. And to look for patterns in the residuals, we can plot them against the different axes. And so here I've taken that trapezoid of residuals and I've plotted it against the calendar year, against the diagonals. in that big trapezoid. And there you have a random scatter of residuals, unless you think maybe there's a pattern in there that hasn't been modeled. Looks like we missed something. Here's an output page out of my model, and what we do here is we say I'm going to put parameters on the calendar year also, but then I kind of smooth them through a technique called filtering. I'm not going to obviously go into the math of it, but in this data set, I have these calendar year trends. So these are trends, as you would think of them, ratio of one diagonal level to the next, and they've been smoothed. So that blue curve is what you get after you filter and smooth the trends on the calendar year for this data. So remarkably regular, almost looks like a sine curve. I would never have predicted it would look that regular, and if you were going to count on it being that regular in the future, I don't know. It was just like really lucky it came out this regular, but it did. So this, but it, what it's clearly showing is that there's something very significant happening, and of course it doesn't look that different from that pattern you saw in the residuals. It's the same, another side of the same thing, except now we've modeled it. And so when we model the calendar year trends and we look at these residuals again, they look like that. So now that's a lot better set of residuals there. Well, one of the ideas of the model is it's a regression kind of model, so I'm modeling the calendar year trend but also the accident year at the same time. So this is the calendar year effect that we got. Well, we should look at the accident year effect also. That is the accident year effect that was left over. So that's kind of the underwriting cycle. The underwriting cycle, not counting what part of it was created after the fact by the trends changing or going bad. This is the underwriting cycle at the accident year level. Now, one thing I should tell you that the fact that if you fit a straight line to that, it would fit horizontal. Exactly horizontal. That's a constraint of the model. So maybe that thing should be, think of it as being tilted a little one way or another, but it's over a long period of time. The interesting aspect, the timing of it, with Tom's timing. The timing of it, if you saw other data, it's not surprising where the peaks and valleys on the underwriting cycle are. What is surprising is that the peak in 1998-99, wherever exactly that is, looks so much higher than the one in the late 80s, which was a real underwriting crisis in workers' comp. I'm not quite sure of all the reasons for that, that it came out that way. Number one, we're looking back at it many years later. It may be that that crisis felt much worse when it was happening than what eventually happened to it, because trends were being, as you're going to see, trends sometimes get over-predicted and under-predicted. And at that time, trends were going so bad that they were probably being over-predicted, and it probably came out to be not quite as bad as people thought. The strange shape in the 80s is something that really happened. For some reason in comp and not other lines of business, there was an extended bad part of the cycle. So these are loss ratio kind of things, so high is bad. It didn't drop the same time as other lines, and this was extended. It was considered quite a crisis, and there was a lot of reforms in comp in the late 80s, early 90s as a response to that crisis. So this kind of stuff really did happen. Of course, it's in the data. This is just, now I'm just going to take in those two pages. These are just the two pictures from the two previous pages. One is trends, one is underwriting things. And just to make them, to put them on the same graph, they've both been normalized, each one divided by its own standard deviation, because they're on totally different kinds of scales. The red line, which is the underwriting cycle, is a scale. It's just the level of the accident years after being corrected by trends and everything else. And the blue line are trends. Their actual annual trends, they're on the diagonal, and their trend factors. So they're different kinds of scales. In one case, the bottom is referring to an accident year. In the other case, it's referring to a calendar year. But boy, you look at those two things and say, it seems like they have something to do with each other. It doesn't seem like they could be unrelated. Not clear why, because the blue line comes straight. One comes straight out of payment data, one's on the accident year, one's on the calendar year trends. The point I'm making, it's not thinking, oh, I believe it's accident year versus I believe it's calendar year. These have been fitted simultaneously. These come from the same model. They're both happening at the same time, and you need both of them in order to fit that data and have decent residuals. Okay, let's talk about the chain ladder. One of the reasons I built that long database, besides fitting models, was just to be able to do back testing. It's so unusual, you know, we do all this to go back and say, gee, how good are these different methods? How would you compare them? Well, we can have models and simulated data to compare them, but maybe some real data to compare them. So what I talked about as an error here is actually a low version of a reserve error. All I did was I took the model and I said, what does the model forecast the next five diagonals of payments will be? Just the next five diagonals of payments, no tail. I didn't put any tail on the 10 years. And that way, I mean, I did 5 years because I wanted to be able to have a decent number of comparisons to look at. So how good is the chain ladder at forecasting 5 years? And that's what the little blue boxes are about. And so for the little blue boxes, the scale on the left is percent is a forecast error. Probably not percent, but a forecast error. So in the high region where you see 1990 through about 1995, it means the chain ladder was over forecasting. It was too high by numbers in the range, in the range of 10-11% compared to what actually happened. That's the chain ladder average two. If I went to average three, then it would be maybe 11%. Average four or five would get up to 12%. 13%, something like that. It gets a little worse as you add more years. And then in the period from, can't move a cursor. Oh, I can move a cursor around on the page. I'm sorry. I didn't know I could do that. Oops. So let me do that so I can point. And then, of course, in this period of time, the chain ladder was under forecasting. And, of course, 2002 is the last time we could make a test because that it's compared to 5 years later, and I had data through 2007. So I superimposed on that, centered at zero, this graph of calendar year trends to say, do these things have anything to do with each other? And I think they do. Look right here. Here, the calendar year trends are peaking, and the chain ladder is actually about right. Here, they're bottoming, and the chain ladder passes through being about right. Whoa. That keeps happening. Here, they're peaking, and the chain ladder's about right again. That seems odd. At the peaks and valleys, you might think you'd be in the worst place, but not really, because the chain ladder, what does the chain ladder assume about calendar year trends? Well, the answer is, first off, nothing clearly discernible, but something. But if there is, if calendar year trends never change, they're always the same, then that's consistent with the chain ladder. So if I'm here at this peak, and I look backwards, somehow my chain ladder has a trend that's similar to what it sees in the past. And now I look forward, and look, it looks the same. Down here, I'm at the valley, I look backward, and I look forward, and it looks about the same. So when the calendar year trend is actually peaking or bottoming out, that's when the chain ladder is most accurate. If I sit right here in the middle of when calendar year trend is dropping, if I look backward, I have a whole 10-year period where trend has been higher than the long-term average. And if I look forward, I have a whole 10-year trend period where trend is going to be lower than the long-term average. So that's probably my worst, that's the midpoint of my period of over-forecasting. And if I look right here, that's the midpoint of my period of under-forecasting. So if you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. So can we do better? Well, I could try to forecast this thing forward. In this case, I did that. I actually fit a time series, and the time series that fits this kind of cyclical-looking thing best among the simple, fairly simple ones is a second-order autoregressive. So I fit it to that blue line, and if I do that, it projects, at least at mean. Obviously, there's a lot of variation, but it projects at mean that red line. In this case, this thing has been so regular, that might actually be a pretty reasonable thing to do. So before we go on to how this works out, let's get back to the question, where do we think we are in the cycle based on this? Well, in the cycle of calendar year trends, according to the red line, we'd be just about bottoming out in 2008. We should be somewhere around the bottom. If you remember, the bottom is the time when the chain ladder forecasts are actually fairly accurate. And in terms of the cycle timing, did I show you that yet? Oh, no, I'm going to show you that. I waited too long. I think I wanted to show you that later, before. In terms of cycle timing, that actually kind of puts you in the middle, not at the peak, not at the valley. It's because the cycle time is very much similar to the way the chain ladder accuracy times. So right now, that would indicate we're in the middle. Right now, we're kind of average profitable, not the most profitable, not the least profitable, and on our way down, but not anywhere near. If history is a guide, not anywhere near a turning point in the cycle. We're on our way down, but, and this is very consistent with the numbers Tom showed you, where he said, we're just about getting to an proper, we've been at a better than economic hurdle rate, according to Tom's analysis. All the lines look like we're getting to somewhere around an economic hurdle rate, and we're on our way to less than an economic hurdle rate. But if history is a guide, we got to go down quite a bit more before we turn. And according to this, the trend cycle will go that way. So does that work? Does this thing work, this idea of forecasting the trend according to this time series? Well, we did do it. We went back and used the DRM model, and it gave us a different forecast from the chain ladder, and we were able to backtest it for at least that number of points on the five-year forecast. So the blue line was the chain ladder forecast error. Remember, in the case of the blue line, it's no longer trends. It's just relative to that value, zero. And the red is the same backtesting I did on my DRM model. And in this data set, DRM minimum was dramatically better, like half the standard deviation. The error is half. Do I think that that is a reproducible result? Frankly, it would be great, but probably not. I'm hopeful that it does prove you can do better than the chain ladder. These trends have such regularity. This sine curve has such regularity. Most data sets don't show that kind of regularity. Are we really confident that this regularity is going to, is there any law that says it's going to continue into the future? When you backtest on this data set, it has continued, and that's why that modeling approach did so well. But it does say, I am confident that you can do better by looking at the trends and by making sure that whatever you're doing in this forecast region is sensible. If I looked at this, and I look what I forecast here, does that seem to be a sensible forecast? When you're doing the chain ladder, the answer to that might be yes, and it might be no, but you have to look. Otherwise, you can't tell. All right. So, back to the cycle. Do calendar year trends create the cycle? Now, what I've done here is I've again superimposed the graphs, but this time I took the underwriting cycle graph and I flipped it over. So it's the same, the red line here is that same underwriting cycle graph, except I flipped it over. Now I call it rate adequacy instead of loss ratio. So now high is good and low is bad. And when you line it up that way, it looks like the blue line leads the red line by about 3 years or so. So does that make sense? Is there any, besides seeing it, does it have any logic? Well, it actually has pretty good logic, because I also superimposed on it the green line, which was the error from the chain ladder. And look at that, at least in this time period, the error from the chain ladder and the underwriting cycle are exactly similarly timed. Exactly. And it's interesting now, this is a chain ladder error on projected reserves at the end of the year, as opposed to the underwriting that's going on in that year. But you know, what you do in reserves, you do in rate making. As a matter of fact, I think actuaries who do reserve spend more time looking at that triangle, at least thinking about those development factors. Actuaries in rate making, it's just a step. And so it's just in there. So they're doing chain ladder and they're doing it blindly. And they might be compounding it, because if you think of your trend on the as an accident year thing, if you do trending and rate making by lining up those ultimates against some kind of exposure base and trending the accident year, well, now if you have a reserve error, of course you have more of that reserve error in the recent accident years because they're more outstanding, less in the old accident years. So if I've got a unfavorable reserve error, I'm understating my reserves. It means I'm understating each accident year by more than the previous one. So I'm under measuring the trend and compounding it. So it may well be that part of it is actuarial mispricing. Oh my God, it's not just those bad guys up in the C-suite not listening to the actuary and putting up low reserves. You know, it's part of that, but it's not all that. Some of it might actually be actuarial mispricing because of these trends in the data that are not being reflected. this does seem to give evidence of that. Certainly, for this example, it's right on the money. Of course, if we flip them back the other way, now it looks like that the red line leads the blue line. That's the problem with these cyclical things. You can say either one leads the other. Any logic to that? Well, actually, you could make, it's not as good a case, but it's still a case. When times are bad, you are stingier with payments. You fight claims harder. You create a temporary depression in the payment trend, which is reversed later, and then that reversal gets further accelerated because when times are good, now you start settling claims more generously. The place you would see that least should be a line like workers' comp, where you have least discretion in paying claims. Well, I wouldn't say you have none. There are settlements in the line. There's always some discretion creeps in across the industry. So it may well be that the industry is putting these trends into the data by the way they behave, intentionally as policy, or not quite intentionally as a reaction to good times and bad times. The industry may be putting trends into the data, and then by not analyzing them correctly, the cycle may be creating trends in the data which create the next cycle. It's an interesting thesis that comes together from this kind of data. I'm sure the investment return is also a factor. It's just it's not in here. The key here is that the red line, the accident year effect, is just as measured the data. So the question of investment returns is, do they help explain it? It wouldn't be part of the model necessarily. I mean, you could try to make it part of the model, but either way, if you want to understand where this cyclical accident year effect comes from, these trends are not the only reason. I'm sure investment returns. Well, for example, this kind of strange plateau here was the underwriting crisis. It was a big workers' comp crisis of the late 80s. And, you know, there's nothing in the blue line that would suggest that. It was obviously something else that made that happen. So, you know, this is clearly not the only explanatory factor, as I said. This is just, this information lag thing is obviously an important contributor, but maybe not the only one. There are other reasons why this might not be plausible. If it happens in the industry overall, that doesn't mean it would happen at every company. Some company, I mean, it could be a matter of policy in terms of suppressing payments or relaxing payments. So you might see this in the industry overall, but you wouldn't necessarily see it at every company. The problem is, I'm going to show you, you kind of see it at every company. This is that underwriting cycle graph, somewhat shorter period of time because I couldn't get the individual company data set quite as far back as I could get the big trapezoid. But I got it pretty far back. And this is the industry against five major members of the blue line individually. And of course, not surprisingly, they all live in the same underwriting cycle. That's all this graph shows, and I don't think anybody would be terribly surprised that they all live in some version of the same underwriting cycle. Of course, not so obvious that they would all have the same calendar year trend cycle. And it's not quite as precisely true, but it's for the most part true that this calendar year trend cycle is afflicting all the companies. So if it was put in by management behavior, I'm not quite sure if this would happen. I'm not sure if the calendar year trend cycle may be something that's happening in the world that's coming to the companies, or it's something that they put in by themselves. But clearly, it's a systemic risk factor that all the companies share that you can't get out of industry data. And when we talk about the risk aspect of it, and we could do that probably from this page, well, this may be a forecast of the red line, but when you see that the trends have this kind of inconsistency, one of the big questions in reserve risk is not where do you think this is, but what's the variation of where it might turn out, what future trends might be. I would say to you that every major reserve model, certainly including the MAC, the bootstrapping method of England and Varal, and all the methods that are being taught, assume that there is no calendar year trend and that it cannot exist, will not exist, has no chance of changing. There is an implicit assumption in all these risk models that nothing can change or will ever change. There's no probability or possibility of anything changing. The only reason we get reserves or pricing wrong is because we've misestimated the parameters. But everything is always the same. Now, imagine going to senior management with the results of a risk analysis and say, I got the process risk and I got the parameter risk. Only thing is, I've assumed that nothing ever changes, ever will, or can ever change. But except for that, I've got all the risks. But we don't say it that way, but I think it's true. I think it's truly in the models. So it just means that you got to add something to those models, whether it's through a model like this or another one. Okay, I think I'm getting near the end. Ah, GL. Just have a few slides. How are we doing on time? 5 minutes, perfect. I tried it for GL, too. Harder for GL. Not as beautiful and clean as comp. Well, for one thing, don't forget GL is just GL. It doesn't actually always mean exactly the same thing, so you don't have that same kind of consistency in definition of the line. I think you have a lot more company variation in how they speed up, slow down calendar year payments, too. But in any case, so we went and fit that GL trend. Now, this first slide is actually one I didn't show for workers' comp. If I'm doing this calendar year trend, it doesn't have something to do with inflation. Well, those workers' comp patterns I showed you were not inflation corrected, and I certainly looked at them against inflation. And I mean, that was over a period of time in which there were huge drops of inflation, and it just didn't make any difference. It was not an inflationary trend. But here, seems to have something to do with inflation when I fit the blue trend line. So if I want to look at that blue trend line, I really have to inflation correct it. And I did this study using these kind of lags, and actually said that the best fit of inflation is at a lag of 8. So I plotted the inflation here against that dotted purple line, which is actually general inflation, some blending of CPI and medical with a heavy weight to medical that I built. But basically, that's a general CPI kind of inflation measure, lagged 8. And maybe it's a coincidence, I think. I think that some of the peaks time the blue line pretty well. And then lag 1 was the second best, and I think I used the yellow line, which is some kind of weight of lag 8 and lag 1 to correct it. And when I corrected it, it looks like that green thing. But while I was at it, I overlaid the green thing against the blue thing from workers' comp. The trends in these lines go together. So it looked like they were going exactly together until that mid-period in 2000, from 2001 to 2005, when GL took an independent dip all its own that workers' comp didn't do. So one question I have is, did that really happen? There was all this aggregate stop-loss reinsurance around 2002 hitting the payments in those years. Workers' comp, it was easy to see and easy to fix because, number one, it doesn't hit payments as soon, and number two, workers' comp payments are so regular that you could really see it when something was happening. They took it out of the pattern, and I had gross data, and if you saw the gross data was perfectly stable and the net data was depressed, I could use the gross data to fix up the net. In GL, you know, the gross data is already pretty unstable, because the line is more naturally unstable. I tried to do all the same things, and I tried to correct the GL, and that's the best I came up with. So that might be a real effect. I'm still struggling with whether I believe that dip really happened or whether I was able to clean that up adequately. Here's the underwriting cycle side of the two of GL and workers' comp. And here you can see that, again, there was that strange thing going on here. What happened, this red line in GL, this is for real, I remember it, 1984, which is about when my data starts, the first good accident year I have. GL data doesn't go back as far as comp. It was horrible. This was, 1984 was probably the worst single underwriting year in the history of the insurance industry, just the bottom of the worst cycle of all time. And then tire market, everything collapsed. It was in all the national newspapers. Nobody could get insurance. Everything collapsed. And within 2 years, it shot from the worst year of all time to the best year of all time. And this really happened. We who are old enough remember it. Late 80s, GL was incredibly profitable following this period of incredible unprofitability. And for some reason, the only line that didn't come along was workers' comp. You jump a little, and then workers' comp kept being bad. Just did not come up. Now, since then eventually there was all these reforms, workers' comp got good, and then everything, of course, gradually started getting bad again together. And they bottomed out in the late 90s, and they peaked again. According to this, actually, not till 2005, a little later than Tom has in his figures. But now, clearly, on the way back down. So it looks like these cycles are timed right together, which makes me question even more whether the cycles are timed right together now and the calendar year trends have really changed that much. Yes? This is actually other liability occurrence. I think I labeled it more clearly on that page. So, and that's one of the reasons my triangle doesn't go back as far, because I could only go back as far until they had that line broken out in the annual statement. So I've gotten away from the claims made, because that has all the D&O stuff mixed in. It gets very hard to do. So that's why I use the occurrence. The D&O, claims made is dominated by professional liability and D&O, and that's a far more unstable thing and has trends and patterns all its own. So try to make it cleaner, I went to the other liability occurrence. I think I have no more. So that's, I really think calendar year trends, it's what separates the past from the future is time. And I think if we're going to understand risk and understand our data, that don't forget time, don't forget the calendar year, seems to explain a lot.
Afternoon. I'm going to take a little bit different perspective, because a lot of the time I spend isn't necessarily doing a lot of the research that Spencer has done, but meeting with management teams and getting an impression of where they think things are going. And I think right off the bat, one of the biggest things I see differently is the cycle is unavoidable, but it's unavoidable because of all the different dynamics that all the many companies in the marketplace are dealing with, whether it be knowing what the right price is. Yes, there's always that issue of getting the right price, but you know, certainly most management teams have a general idea of what the adequate price is in their marketplaces. Then the question is, where do they want to position themselves, and what's their issue in terms of their market share and what they're trying to focus on? Are they trying to grow in that area or shrink in that area? So, you know, what I went through is kind of looking at the cycle and what are the driving factors in the cycle, and then I'll close with some of the things that what we're seeing that are changing the dynamics of the cycle to some extent. These are some of the key pieces, and I have charts that'll go through each of these in more detail, but whenever we start to see surplus and the level of surplus, and usually premium to surplus is the simplest gauge that's out there, that will be a driving force in terms of pricing. Companies are looking for a way. They're planning. They're in their planning process, looking at their capital management. What am I doing with my capital? How am I putting to use? What level of returns am I getting back? And this is particularly true with stock companies and publicly traded companies. But it's also true for some of the leading mutuals who go through the same planning processes. Some of them have the same earnings calls for some of their note holders that are out there, that are talking about how they're using their capital and their planning process. So when they start to see themselves build up capital, they're looking for ways to put that capital to use, and oftentimes that comes in the form of growth in different marketplaces. It also can come in the form of M&A activity or returns as well. Investment returns, you'll see as well a fairly close track to where the investment returns are, just, you know, the equity markets as a key impact, but we looked at return on invested assets and kind of trended it along relative to premium growth and seeing where premium starts to pick up. And we use premium growth as kind of a proxy for companies starting to push rate. Underwriting profitability, and you saw that with some of the stuff that Spencer had, clearly that's a driving piece to, you know, when a company starts, when the industry as a whole starts to see things and push rate, but that will vary from company to company. And finally, the return on equity or surplus. It's not necessarily just an issue of, well, of course, if you have excess capital, you're going to have a lower return. This is looking more at when you combine the issue of investment returns along with underwriting returns, and companies are looking much more closely at the overall total return in determining their pricing strategy and their planning process. This chart is one that I taken from a presentation I saw from Cochrane Coronia. And what you see in the bar charts is the actual net ins and outs of capital. So what you're seeing here in the downside is where companies are paying shareholder dividends up to their holding companies. They're removing, paying larger dividends out of the industry. And what you see on the upside, you can see 1994 through 95, you know, returns. You can see obviously after 9/11, you see a fair amount of increase in capital going in, and you can see the dip there between 2005, where there had been a lot of capital coming out of the industry, but after Katrina, there was a lot of capital that flowed back into the industry that alleviated that one piece where you see a major outflow of capital. So you can see kind of how the pricing cycle, capital coming out through 2000, you see the turn and you see pricing start to move up as companies realize, wait a second, you know, that capital outflow also was a resulted in inadequate pricing as companies pushed to utilize their capital. You saw prices go up. The same thing as you see come through 2004 through 2008. You saw prices start to move downward, and now we're starting to see some movement upward, somewhat relating to the excess capital piece that was built up in 2005, 6, and 7, or actually 2006 and 7. This is a chart that goes back, I guess, 20, 35 years, that looks at premium to surplus and just gives you some idea where we've come. The blue line is net written premium to surplus, and that goes to the scale here on the side closest to me. If you look at the yellow line, it's premium growth. And you can see as there's dips down in terms of the net written premium to surplus, there's a lag back to the fact that companies start to realize the rate adequacy and the pricing that's out there is not where it should be, and you start to see a movement up in premium, and typically it's coming through in rate increases. What we'd seen coming through here, you start to see people are talking about a hardening of the market in 2008 and 2009, and the numbers for 2008, 2009 come out of our preview projections that we have. But if you look at it, you know, they're talking about a firming of the market, but when you look at where net written premium to surplus is for year-end 2008, it's still below where we were at any other point. It's basically about where we were in 1998, 1999. So there's still a lot of capital out there. Companies have felt a lot of pressure from their investment returns, but there's still a lot of capital that they have that some companies have to put into place. So that's one of the off-balancing things about where's this hardening of the market coming from. And it's not coming from the traditional net written premium to surplus or perceived excess capital from that basis. But when you look at this issue, this is where it comes back to this firming of the market is a little bit different from what we've seen historically. And you can see 2008, most companies had a particularly poor year in terms of net income. And looking at that, the investment losses that all companies had to absorb, as well as, you know, when you look at some of the pension funding that they had to put up, that's been a cause in terms of why companies have perceived themselves not to have the level of capital that they feel they need to continue to write at the same level and be aggressive in the marketplace. Even if you go back to the prior slide and see that net written premium to surplus isn't necessarily that high, the poor results and poor returns that they have on their investment side has really pushed some of the pricing and reduced some of the capacity, particularly in the reinsurance markets. You see a reduced capacity. You see a reduced capacity in the primary markets. And what you're seeing from there is that the primary markets then feel that they need capacity, they look to utilize a greater amount of reinsurance. Well, there's a lower supply of reinsurance, so that drives the price up. It basically is a cycle that squeezes back to pushing primary rates up higher as well, because they have to push through the reinsurance rates. This one looks at the typical underwriting trends that are there. And what I have there in the neon green, I apologize for the color, I thought it looked nice on my slides, but a little bright there. That is what I refer to as a normalized accident year. And what I do there is I take out the catastrophe losses for the year and look at the accident year on a normalized basis to try to get a where would it been without the catastrophes. And then the blue line is just the reported calendar year results. And you can see, again, it comes back to the industry pretty well knows where things are going. You see a lag from the worst of the underwriting results typically to the spike up in pricing, and usually that relates to just the lag in the reserving error that might be there. But the response to my profitability is just not where I want it to be, rates start to move up. And that's, from my perspective, most company management teams have an idea of where they want to be. And I'll talk a little bit later, more on that later. But you can see that the kind of, certainly in the right around 2000 time frame where the spike up, the lag is right there. And you're starting to see it here. I mean, there's some aspect to the underwriting results. There's some concern. Well, they're still fairly strong relative to if you go back in the 80s and 90s, there still is some concern about where they're at. And that relates where you go back to not just underwriting returns, but where are the investment returns as well. When you put everything together more on a total return basis, you can't have the combined ratio go to the levels that it would go to 15 years ago. And this gets back to the total return. When you look at the net income, after-tax net income to policyholder surplus and premium growth, you can see that the spike in the middle after 9/11, 2001 timeframe, you saw prices move up greatly. As pricing and returns continue to remain strong, even with the four hurricanes in Florida in 2004, Katrina, Rita, William in 2005, 2006 and 2007 without any major catastrophes, pricing was coming down, but because of the lack of catastrophes, you saw continued improvement. Well, you can see that there's the one spike in there for Katrina and the property rates after Katrina, but for the most part, you saw a continued downward pricing trend to the point that those two negative premium growth numbers in 2007 and 2008 are the first negative growth periods, I think, back-to-back negative growth since the 1940s, I think it was 1937, was the last time we had back-to-back negative growth in premium for the property casualty insurance industry. 2005, well, that's a slightly below zero. That number is distorted by one very large loss portfolio transfer by one of the reinsurers. And if you take that out, it's actually growth of about 1% for that year. But when you look at really where this industry is and the fact that for years, even in the worst years, they'd have at least 2% growth in premium, it relates somewhat to the lack of inflation as well as just the pricing levels that are there in the industry. But you can see that, you know, the projections for increase in premium growth in 2009, I think, reflects somewhat where the pricing is. The improvement in net income to policyholder surplus in 2009 just gets back to the investment markets as well. Just to give you some perspective of where we feel we're at in the cycle. It looks like the soft cycle is beginning to stabilize and we're seeing some hardening of the market. For the most part, this hardening that we're seeing in terms of the pricing is driven more by the investment side than it is the underwriting side. There are still lines that, there still is considerable pressure. Some companies are specifically commented on in terms of their pricing pressures. And again, it gets back to individual management teams and the pressures that they're under. And what are they trying to address within their operations? They're all working through. They take the numbers from actuaries, but an actuarial indication and rate making is not what drives the pricing of companies and what drives the pricing in the marketplace. From our perspective, capital remains adequate. Most companies on the property casualty side are well managed, and on the investment side, didn't take a lot of risk. I'm glad I'm not my counterpart on the life side. The life industry has a lot of issues, and the companies that we see having issues on the property casualty side, usually it's linked to something tied to a life issue, or if perhaps they had something that came out of Hurricane Ike. The losses there are compounded with losses in the investments. The one concern that we have looking forward is where is the additional capital? Should there be a major catastrophe at this point? You saw in 2001, you saw in 2005, a tremendous flow of capital into the industry. In 2005, it came into ongoing companies, it came in the form of startups, it came in the form of sidecars. The capital markets aren't necessarily prepared to do that. You can see what's going on in terms of the credit markets right now. And I don't think that there's much in the way of hedge funds that are going to try to fund and take advantage of the pricing at this point. So the industry could be in a pretty hard time in terms of adequate capital. You will see if that occurs, you likely will see pricing in the marketplace move significantly higher just because of capacity issues that are available to companies. When you look at the investment markets, we don't necessarily view ourselves as investment market analysts, but I don't think anybody would disagree that there's quite a bit of uncertainty in 2009. And the issue comes back to management. When you look at everything that's going on, management teams, the stronger management teams still seem to stand out. When you go through and look across the industry and you look at specific companies, there are certain companies that continuously do well in troubled times, whether it be soft markets, whether it be times like this in terms of investments, and those companies over the long term stand out above the rest of the companies. To the point about the underwriting cycle is, from our perspective, they can be managed. And there are specific companies that do a very good job of managing down their risk during the soft cycle, and they are very aggressive when rates start to turn, and they will push price and move for market share at that point in time. They tend to be more conservative with their reserving. They tend to be, you'll see them shrink at times of weakness. I've seen companies go from $70 million down to $20 million, and those companies ran at 95 combined ratios through the 1990s until they got to the point of $20 million, and they decided we have to at least start to give some on the rate because we have expenses we have to cover, and you saw their combined ratios climb up over 100. Once the hard market came in 2002, 2003, they were back up to $80 million in premium again. And it comes back to the management team and their philosophy. Capital management, it's all part of the management overall in the planning process, looking at the available capital, but not looking at how can you put it to use. You have to consider where are you in the market. Just because you have capital doesn't mean you should turn around and give it away to policyholders. And those companies that do a good job of managing their overall plan for where they want to be are holding back that capital or returning that capital to shareholders, but they're not out there just pushing to move into new states, move into new lines just because they have excess capital. I mentioned management several times, but management leadership is a key, and their focus on long-term profitability. It's not just where am I going in the next couple years, but if they're really truly focused on long-term profitability, they're willing to give back some in terms of business during the soft cycle. They perform throughout the market. And it really does come back to company culture as well. There's many times I sit there with senior management, and usually every meeting when you start to see rates turn, our company will not write to an underwriting loss. And you just wonder, who else are they saying it to? Because they don't seem to be saying it to their underwriters. It's amazing how it's improving. It's not as bad as it used to be, but so many senior management teams would come in and spout the line, and I'm sure they said it to every rating agency they went to talk to, that they won't cut price to keep business. But it's a slippery slope. That little 5% give on this business and 5% on the next, then your competitor moves a little bit, so you move a little bit more. It's human nature, and it's a slippery slope, and that's why the underwriting cycle is so unavoidable. It's something you can manage from a company, and you have to draw the line. I think back to when I was in the industry over 20 years ago, the company I was at had something they referred to as floor pricing or floor factors. And these were the underwriting factors in terms of percent of manual that you could go. and then you use that, you calculate it versus premium, you had dollar weighted, and you had a bank that you could use. If you went above, you could, you know, go below on somebody else. Unfortunately, it was a report that was run once a month, which now is kind of fixed with data issues. The other issue is the fact that if we ended up with a bank below, they just changed the rules and said, okay, you can't go this far below. And if you don't use these tools, it doesn't make any difference. You have to use the tools. And you know, when I look back at that system, it was probably ahead of its time in terms of the development and the people to put it together. But again, it comes back to senior management enforcing that and pushing that issue and what they're after for price. Spencer talked a little bit about it, but this is one of my pet peeves, and particularly this year with all the companies that are looking for earnings and where are my earnings coming from. And you know, I heard it when I got to AM Best. I was the actuary for the department, and I'd sit there and I'd talk to companies. I'd say, just your reserves just do not look adequate. And I'd hear, well, we did this to our underwriting, and we took 5% credit for this. And you know, when you look at the loss trends, they're, you know, we know they're negative, but they're not quite that negative. And you know, and then I go back to the point this year about the pressures for earnings. And when you start to do that and you start to let management influence what really is true judgment in terms of projections, you know, that's going to lead to inadequate loss reserves. That's going to then in turn come back, because when you're setting up inadequate losses, typically, you know, a lot of that is linked into setting, you know, doing your rate making and coming up with your loss picks that feed your rate making. At one point, you know, I saw a company that, okay, we're doing all this work for reserving. Let's make sure we use those loss ratio picks to feed our rate making. Well, that just, there's your cycle right back through. And, you know, inadequate premium, then you come back and you set your IBNR based on your premium. What happens when you see companies like this is 3 or 4 years later, they take a $50 million reserve charge or whatever size is appropriate for their company. If you're CNA, you take $3 billion every year. I remember, I think it was 2001 and 2003, and it was, you know, $3 billion in 2001, $3 billion in 2003, and in 2005 I was waiting for Steve Lowenthal to come in again, but he didn't that time, luckily. You know, the issue of reserving is you can't get caught in that cycle. You have to focus on what are the issues that are there, and again, it's a philosophy that management drives. You know, actuaries run the numbers, actuaries come through, they make a presentation, but management sets the reserves. You know, my first 6 months at my first job, I got a call, I worked on the IBNR factors, and you know, they were approved by my manager, and got a call from IS, should we put those factors into the system? They let them go, and you know, for one day I had the largest reserve strengthening in that company until 10 years later when they finally did take all the reserve strengthening, because management wouldn't approve the factors that were indicated that were out there. They, you know, they felt there were other issues that drove reserves, and it comes back to a philosophy. Just wanted to touch a little bit on ERM, because it's been talked about so much in this industry. The actuarial community has a whole new session on it now. But it has had an impact, and I do think it's changing the cycle to some extent. The biggest thing is the data and the data availability. Companies have spent a lot of time working on improving their systems, and they have access to data. Senior management, you know, you talk to senior management now, and they talk about, yeah, I look at the runs for every policy we wrote yesterday. It's not the monthly report that I was talking about 20 years ago. That's a huge issue. It's really improved management controls. It's allowed them to address issues when they see underwriters that are starting to move more quickly on pricing than management wants. I think it gets back to the point of management telling us that we're not going to write an underwriting loss. It at least allows them to see if somebody's doing it. Hopefully, management is communicating back to the underwriters and the issues that they're seeing, so that, you know, that we're not going to write an underwriting loss gets back through to everybody in their company. But ERM is certainly a venue, and the data that's out there helps in terms of improvement. I think the whole process of enterprise risk management should help overall for companies as senior management works closer with individual silo type of aspects that are out there, whether it be pricing or catastrophe risk, reinsurance utilization. All those forms should get closer together. And that concludes my prepared remarks. I don't know. Do you want to open to questions?
Okay, we have 15 minutes for questions. Are there any?
I don't have a percentage for you. No more than a third of it. You know, it's still, like I said, the chain ladder may be inaccurate, but it's still at least three times as good as the reserves that three times as accurate as the book reserves. So, you know, obviously, most of it is still not that, but I think it might have more of a multiplier effect. But you know.
We could, the loss variation, but then maybe in addition, you have the premium variation of the pricing cycle.
Right. I'm saying it does not explain most of the pricing cycle. It's interestingly timed with the pricing cycle. It seems to be a more interesting contributing factor than we would have thought, because it's very easy for us to say if they just did what the actuarial indications were, everything would be fine. And the reality is if they just did what the actuarial indications were, everything would be a lot better. But we still, but we as actuaries can still do better too.
Okay. Others?
When you had the opportunity to look at how, as the economy moves up and down, how that relates to the recovery cycle?
In the numbers I looked at, mostly not. It's, you know, it's like we have our own economy, yeah. Our own world. Of course, there's, you know, I didn't talk much about the investment side, and sometimes what's going on in the investment world can drive things. There was a shock upcycle in the mid-70s, which was investment-driven. The insurance companies lost a lot of money on the investment side, and that curve caused a firming. And I think with this high idea, my data was a little older, would say we'd kind of be in the middle of the cycle, not firming that much yet, but maybe there's extra firming going on in 2009. I haven't seen those numbers yet. And that would make sense, and probably, as Matt says, being driven by losses of capital, poor capital, you know, problems that are coming from elsewhere than the underwriting.
Yeah, and I mean, I've seen different things that were written up that the tie to the overall economy overall isn't as tight as, you know, some people would think in terms of, you know, just workers' comp and the auto. I mean, there is certainly some relationship, but doesn't drive the overall cycle as much as people would expect. I think, you know, what we're saying is certainly that the investments have driven some of it, but even that isn't driving it extremely hard. And I don't want to imply that there's a, you know, real hard market on the way. I think what we've seen is a firming is probably a better way to say it. Prices aren't dropping anymore. They're, you know, flat to some extent. And I don't expect that they're going to go spiking up through just because of the overall level of capital as it is, but the investments are one of the key reasons as to why they've even started the firm.
Other questions? Please. I'm sorry, I didn't hear the beginning of the question. Oh, are they unavoidable?
No. I mean, it actually demonstrates a fairly competitive marketplace. I mean, when you consider if you get away from all the regulation that's out there in terms of rate regulation, this clearly shows the competition, because my point is companies are out there making all kinds of decisions on what they want to do. But what happens is that will tend to, if pricing is profitable, it's going to push the market back down. If it's unprofitable, it's going to raise rates back up. If that's not a competitive marketplace, I don't know what is.
Well, I would agree that it's clearly caused by competition. The cycle is good. To say that the cycle is a good thing, I mean, competition is a good thing. And if it is, if the cycle is an inevitable effect of competition, then we've got to have it, because competition is a good thing. But I think some of the cycle, you know, you can call it underwriting, but you can call it capital, and it has, those are obviously tied to each other, because obviously when you've had good results, the industry capital goes up and down. I think if capital flowed in and out
more readily, if there wasn't so many, you know, if that was more frictionless, and right now it's probably got more friction than ever, so then I think that could alleviate cycle problems, because what happens now is after good times, companies build up capital for which they can't really get a return out from underwriting business. It's just not there, and that is something that is helping to fuel that more competition, companies trying to find other ways, but ultimately driving price down. Whereas if they could just get rid of it, okay, I've got too much capital now, let me just give it back. Of course, they won't do it because they're not sure they can get it later when they need it. It doesn't flow in and out seamlessly and without cost. In the property catastrophe reinsurance market, it flows a little more freely. So they set themselves up to be in a position where in a really bad cat, they can lose half their capital and then go out and replenish it. So they're more efficient. They're using capital more efficiently that way because they had the mechanism for it to flow in and out. For insurance companies especially, it doesn't flow in and out so fast, so companies aren't giving it back when they have too much of it, and that is part of what drives cycles.
Just two things. They can't lose half their capital and keep their rating, just in that part. The other thing that I think that comes into play sometimes, and you touched on a little bit, Spencer, is the fact that when you have two different types of companies operating in the industry, and you have mutuals that really don't have a lot of access to capital, and you have stock companies that have more access to capital, you know, when capital builds up in mutuals, you know, sometimes it's, well, I need that excess capital for the bad times, but at the same point, they start to be as competitive as the stock companies who are using that capital. Stock companies could give it back. Mutuals give it back to their policyholders. They can't get it back. You know, it's very difficult for a mutual to recapitalize. And I think that probably plays into some of the dynamics of the cycles themselves and just how capital's used.
As a follow-on to that, do you think that, you know, we're here at the rate-making seminar and now predictive modeling is part of this seminar, and they're talking about various methods, more sophisticated pricing methods to further slice and dice the rating data. Do you think that those methods would possibly dampen the underwriting cycle?
I mean, I'm not a big believer that rate-making is driving the underwriting cycle. It's human nature. It's senior management, it's underwriters that need to have still to some extent feel pressure to get X amount of business on the books. Mm-hmm. That if I give this 5%, I'll get this business. If I don't, I'll lose this business. I just don't think that rate making, and you can get as sophisticated as you want, I think the market has a pretty good idea where the price is, and rate making isn't going to make a major difference.
I'm not a predictive modeling expert. I've always viewed that as more of a price discrimination issue, charging the right price for the right risk, which is really obviously incredibly important competitive behavior for insurance companies versus each other in rate discrimination. But I don't know, I'm not knowledgeable, I don't know where if it changes the overall profitability.
I think it helps in the underwriting side and choosing your risks.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And looking at it from that perspective, but not from necessarily saying I've set a rate. I mean, really what it helps is guiding the underwriting department in terms of what risks they want to go after and what risk, you know, that 5% I talked about, what risk is it worth giving that 5% to and which one wouldn't.
Right.
I've seen a lot of predictive models that I think, you know, do help, and when they backtest them, have shown to work in that regard, in improving their book and where they're putting their credits towards, but they're still going to utilize their credits. And I think it comes back to management being more stringent in utilizing those type of predictive models and, you know, squeezing underwriters to be more focused on that profitability aspect.
Okay. We have time for another question. Well, if not, I'd like you to join me in thanking our presenters today.